Bo's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and we hope you'll stay tuned for this special edition of PTR. Our guest is one of the organizers of the Jubilee 2000 campaign, Professor Dennis Brutus.
Corporations make the rules. They make the rules for the corporations. Make them for profit. Make them against people. Make them for exploiting people even more, for recolonizing Africa. Of course, the WTO could not do this if it was not that it was working with the World Bank and the IMF.
Professor Brutus joins us to discuss the upcoming protests at the World Bank and IMF meetings, which are scheduled to take place in mid-April in Washington, D.C. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Originally from South Africa, Dennis Brutus was held prisoner on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela. He's been an international organizer, and he joins us to talk about the Jubilee 2000 campaign, as well as the upcoming protest at the International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings scheduled for Washington, D.C. in mid-April. We're going to talk about Jubilee 2000 and also the upcoming meetings and protests which will be taking place regarding the IMF and World Bank when they meet in mid-April in Washington, D.C. But I would, sir, if we can, just to try and go back a little bit, because I know that you were at one time incarcerated with Nelson Mandela on Robben Island in South Africa. That's correct, right?
That's correct.
Talk, if you will, about what happened, because you were very politically active in apartheid South Africa to the point where the regime decided they needed to imprison you.
I grew up in a segregated area in a ghetto in South Africa, and I protested the apartheid racism in education, in housing, and in jobs. So that got me into trouble with the apartheid government. But interestingly, the thing that got me into most trouble was when I protested apartheid in sport. Black athletes could not run with white athletes. They could not be on the Olympic team. So I organized the protest against that. We got 60,000 people together. And we got South Africa expelled from the Olympic Games. They were expelled until 1992. They were out for nearly 30 years. And I was responsible largely for that. But I ended up in prison on Robben Island. I was banned from meetings, banned from organizations. I broke the ban, and so I was arrested for that. I escaped twice, once in Johannesburg, and once I escaped across the border, got into Mozambique. But then the Portuguese police, secret police, arrested me, handed me back to the South African police, took me to Johannesburg. I was shot in the back by a member of the secret police. Then ended up on Robben Island, the Breaking Stones, with Mandela and Walter Sisulu and Mbeki, others in the resistance. Of course, I'd worked with Mandela before I went to prison. When he went underground, he used my home as one of the places for hiding. And I'd also worked with Walter Sisulu, organizing a convention against the apartheid government. So I was pretty active, but I think we should leave that and talk about my activity when I came out, because I then organized protests in Britain and came to the United States and got all involved in the protests. Yeah, especially the divestment movement, which you may remember was very effective. We've got 150 universities to take their money out of the corporations in South Africa, which led, of course, to the new government. South Africa is only halfway towards democracy. Most of the money, most of the power, the corporations, the gold mines, diamond mines, still in white hands. You can change the faces of the politicians, but the reality is that real economic power in South Africa still in the hands of a white minority. with, of course, a few blacks who can now sit on the board of De Beers Diamond Mines or on the gold mines. There's a place for them, but power is still in the hands of a minority.
You brought up the divestment efforts that were so successful in changing things to the degree that they've been changed in South Africa. We have a recent attempt by a state here in the United States where they tried to do that with Myanmar, formerly Burma, and now what we have is the United States government and the WTO attempting to say that the same types of things that were used to help cause the change that happened in South Africa are illegal under World Trade Organization rules. They saw how successful that was and want to stop it from happening again, it seems.
I'm glad you bring that up because it's a very interesting combination of the South African issue and our struggle there and the struggle now against the World Trade Organization. What Massachusetts is doing is the same thing that states and churches and trade unions did against apartheid. But now the WTO is saying that Massachusetts cannot do it. And they're not only saying that Massachusetts cannot do it, but they've got the United States government. The Justice Department is taking the state of Massachusetts to court and telling them you can't do it. And, of course, what people, most of them, I'm reading the reports about it, people don't know that the pressure against Massachusetts, which is coming from the U.S. Justice Department, is actually coming from the World Trade Organization, which has decided that you can no longer organize boycotts against people who violate human rights, because free trade is more important than people. Profits are more important than people. And so the WTO, together with the U.S. government, is now trying to stop Massachusetts from boycotting a country where the people are being jailed, they're being beaten, they're being tortured, they're being killed. If we have a moment, I want to squeeze in a reference to something which is also related to this. I have in front of me, as I'm talking to you, a letter from Leon Sullivan, and it's all about a summit which was held in Washington. They're going to have another summit in Washington where they're going to invite President Clinton on June 22nd. What is this about? It's about black Americans who were helping us in the struggle against apartheid, although Leon Sullivan was not one of them, because he was stooging for GM. He happened to be on the board of GM and was saying he went to South Africa and all the blacks were smiling and happy. But here's the point. We now have black Americans, African Americans, who instead of opposing oppression are saying, let's get into Africa with the corporations, because there's a lot of money to be made in Africa from recolonizing Africa, from exploiting the people of Africa. So I know I'm bringing this in, and it wasn't part of your question, but it's so important that I think we're going to have to discuss it.
Let's talk, if we can, now about the IMF and the World Bank, because the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank, I've heard them referred to in one instance as the unholy trinity. Perhaps we can talk about them first,
right,
then talk about Jubilee 2000.
Right, and of course the two are connected, but I'm glad that it's easier if we separate them. The World Bank and the IMF, of course, have been around for more than 50 years. They were created at Bretton Woods in 1945. But the WTO is really the child of the IMF and the World Bank. So it's a good way to describe them as an unholy trinity. Roughly, if I were to make it very simple, I would say the IMF makes the policies, the World Bank gives the money, and the WTO is the kind of enforcer that to make sure that you obey the rules after they've drawn up the rules. Of course, the WTO is an unelected body. Nobody's voted for them. They consist mainly of CEOs of corporations. They meet in secret. Their decisions are in secret. And even President Clinton, when he arrived in Seattle, had to say the protesters are right, that the WTO should not be meeting in secret. He was actually expressing support with the protesters because one of the key elements of the WTO is secrecy. The corporations make the rules. They make the rules for the corporations, make them for profit, make them against people, make them for exploiting people even more, for recolonizing Africa. But of course, the WTO could not do this if it was not that it was working with the World Bank and the IMF. So we have to talk quickly about one aspect of how the World Bank succeeds in dominating the world, and especially third world countries. And you're right, this crosses all racial barriers. It exploits people in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in the Caribbean. It's all about exploitation. Race is just a secondary part of it. But what we see now is that the World Bank comes up with what are called SAPs, Structural Adjustment Programs. It goes to countries and says, hey, here's a program for you. You have to follow this program, and if you follow the program, we will give you money. Aha, but it's always money with strings attached, what are called conditionalities. So the countries that get money, whether it's Zimbabwe or Ghana or Kenya, whether it's Ecuador or Nicaragua or Colombia, whether it's the Philippines or Malaysia, Indonesia or Thailand, always there are strings attached. And those strings say, you have to change your economy to satisfy not the people of your country, but the people of the West. The people in the highly industrialized countries who run the World Bank and who run the IMF, your people have to serve our people. And the wealth has to be taken out of your country into our country. We get billionaires. You get beggars. Those who have get more. Those who have almost nothing, even the little they have, is taken away from them. They're homeless. They're jobless. Landless. So you have a process now which we call the recolonization of Africa and of the third world, where countries are told your whole economy has to be changed to be structured to serve export, to serve other countries, not your own people. And here's one bad thing as well. The money that comes into a country has to be used first to pay the debt to the World Bank, the IMF, and the First World Banks, so that they are called priority creditors. You first have to pay them. If you have any money left over, then you can put it into housing and schools and hospitals, water and roads, but you have to service the debt first. Social services for the people have to wait. This is what the globalizing process is about. This is what we are challenging through organizations like Jubilee 2000, and I hope we'll get into that. But of course, there are other organizations as well.
We're speaking with Professor Dennis Brutus, one of the organizers of Jubilee 2000. Professor Brutus, can we talk a little bit more about the reality of these structural adjustment programs and this crushing debt? Because I don't know necessarily that many people in the United States really understand the devastation that is happening around the world as a result of these SAPs and just the massive foreign debt that these countries can't hope to ever pay off.
Right. I wish we had time, Mike, but as we said, we want to talk about Jubilee 2000 as well. So let me just make a couple of quick points. In many cases, countries are in the third world are told the World Bank will give you money, but instead of growing food, you have to grow tobacco because with the tobacco, you can earn dollars, and with the dollars, you can pay us back, because we only take dollars. We don't take local money. Or in other places, in Kenya, they say tobacco is an example, in Zimbabwe, where the people now have to import corn from South Africa because they were told to switch the economy, the agriculture, growing tobacco instead of corn. And Zimbabwe used to export corn. Now it's importing corn. Kenya, they said, you stop growing food, grow tea or grow flowers. Would you believe? Flowers that they fly refrigerated from the airport out of Nairobi into Europe. But the people of Kenya have to stop growing food, turn over the land to growing tea. So this is the way structural adjustment works. In India, they said, oh, we have to build these big dams, you know, remove thousands of peasants off the land, where they've been living for centuries, growing food, keeping their cattle, keeping sheep or goats or cows. So you have a dramatic change in the economy of a country dictated by the World Bank to serve the interests of the highly industrialized countries and against the interests of the people in those countries. There are women in Zimbabwe who do not have milk in their breasts to feed their children because there's not enough food. There are places in India where people are drinking polluted water because they don't have decent water. But, of course, it's happening right here in America, across the border in the maquiladoras of Mexico as a result of NAFTA. People are having their environment polluted. So it's a pattern all over the world. The important thing to be aware of is that it's done in the name of so-called free trade, and that it is aimed not at servicing the people of the underdeveloped or our developing countries, but to make more wealth out of billionaires in the north and in the western countries.
We're speaking with Professor Dennis Brutus. Professor Brutus, let's talk about Jubilee 2000.
Right. Now, there's one important thing to be aware of here, that we now have 65 Jubilee 2000 movements all over the world, but they don't all share the same goals. So I think it's important to remember that, say, Jubilee 2000 in the USA, which is interested largely in reform, is different, say, from Jubilee 2000 in Africa or in Asia, which talks about abolishing the World Bank, abolishing the IMF, abolishing the WTO. And we could come back to those differences in a moment. But the important thing is that there are 65 of them all over the world, powerful. One of the goals they all share is either the cancellation of debt, or some would call it the forgiveness of debt, of these countries that are burdened with debt. In Africa, sub-Sahara Africa alone, is estimated $200 billion debt, a debt they will never be able to repay because they are being bled just by servicing those debts. Forget about the capital amount. But you have all these Jubilee movements, and they're all targeting the year 2000, and they're all targeting the meeting of the G7, or maybe G7 and a half, if they invite the Russians, which will take place in July. Now, we've had demonstrations every time they have a G7 summit. Last year, we put 40,000 on the streets of Cologne in Germany when the G7 or the 7.5 were meeting there. The previous year in Birmingham in England, we put 70,000 on the streets, forming a human chain around the center where the heads of state were meeting. And that chain was a symbol of the chain of debt that is strangling the countries of the world so that they can't develop. This year, the G7 is meeting in Japan. In fact, they're meeting in Okinawa. So not many of us are going to be able to demonstrate in Okinawa. What we are talking of instead, and I hope this idea will reach other people as well. So I hope you'll put it out through the media and through the web and the net, is that when the G7 is meeting in July in Okinawa, we will be having meetings all over the world, and particularly in the capitals of the G7 countries, Britain and France, Italy, Germany, United States, Canada, and Japan. So that in all those capital cities, there will be protests demanding the cancellation of debt according to the Bible, which says in the book of Leviticus that when you come to the end of a period, say 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, you forgive your enemies, you cancel your debt, and you make a new start. And we're saying Jubilee 2000 is the year to make a new start and to cancel the debt. So there are going to be big demonstrations in July. But as you know, we are going to have big demonstrations before July. That after Seattle, we are now getting ready for Washington in April. So I hope we can just spend a minute on that.
Please do.
Again, in Washington, we're going to have two kinds of events. And the first series of events is organized by Jubilee 2000 USA, together with a large group of co-sponsoring organizations. And they will be organizing a human chain in Washington on Sunday, April 9, and they're asking everybody who can to be there and to organize for the demand against the World Bank, against the IMF, and calling for the cancellation of debt. So there's a series of events which will climax around about April 9. But then you have another series of events starting after April 9, going on to April 16, which will be organized by the same people who organized the protests in Seattle. 50 years is enough, the Rainforest Action, the Global Action Groups, all demanding the end of the kind of corporate globalization that we see in our time, and instead we want a more humane society in which people will participate, a society in which people will be more important than profits. So I will be part of both of these series of events, but I particularly hope that people are going to organize events for April 16, because that's the day when both the IMF and the World Bank will be holding their spring meetings. I should just mention one other activity which is very important. On April 14, something called the International Forum on Globalization will be holding an all-day seminar open to the public from 10 in the morning until 10 at night. And this will be at the Methodist Church in Washington, where President Clinton usually worships. So people really should try, if they can, to be at the events around April 9, also the events around April 14, and the events around April 16. I will also be involved in one other event, a press conference on April 10, when we start a campaign to get churches, trade unions, universities to boycott the bonds which are held by the World Bank. And people will say, we will not purchase any bonds from the World Bank because the World Bank uses that money in order to oppress billions of people around the world. We're going to take that money away from them. And when we take that money away, we will be weakening their power.
We're speaking with Professor Dennis Brutus. Professor Brutus, we just have a couple of minutes left, and there's really, I guess, one question I wanted to ask you, and then also ask you if there's any contact information if people want to get involved in any of these events or be supportive of them. But I guess the question I have to go back to is, you talked about whether or not these institutions can be reformed or whether they need to be abolished. I'd like to get your thoughts briefly on that.
Right. I'm going to keep it short, but my own view is that while my belief is that they should be abolished, that's my position, I would call for them to be abolished, I believe before we do that, there's something very important we should do, and this was decided in Seattle, and that is we have to study the record of these organizations, the World Bank, IMF, the WTO, and their record will show how destructive they have been, how they have damaged people, how they have worked against human rights and in favor of profit of the corporations. Abolition, yes, but before abolition, let's develop the case. Let's show that the evidence is there that these organizations work not for human beings, but work instead for the corporations and for their profit. On the web, it's www.a16.org. I repeat that, www.a16.org. That's for the web. Telephone for everybody. This is quite useful. Area code 202 and then IMFBANK. If you just remember that and find the numbers and hit those buttons. 202 area code IMFBANK. If you want to write to the organization, and not all of us have the kind of computer access that one day we will all have, but while you don't have it, you can write to 50 Years Is Enough. That's the name of the organization. 50 Years Is Enough. And I will give you their mailing address, which is 1247 E Street. 1247 E Street, Southeast, Washington, D.C., 20003, Washington, D.C., 20003.
Professor Dennis Brutus, thank you for being with us on the program, sir, and hopefully we can check in with you in the future to keep track of this very important issue.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I would be glad to be on your program some other time.
That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. Thanks to the overwhelming response to PTR in our first year, the program is now available twice monthly and on the internet at www.ptradio.org. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies of robotics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide is used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or our other print and audio publications, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. My name is Mike Thornton. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.